You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. I'm very honored to introduce tonight's guests, two distinguished guests, Eileen Miles and Maggie Nelson, who are longtime friends, mutual influences, confidants. And tonight, through their words, we will wander through a space of possibility, where landscape and dreamscape collide, where a hole in a sweater becomes a hole in memory, where gender, as Eileen describes a friend, describing it to her is, quote, not what you're doing, it's who you think you are when you're doing what you're doing. Eileen Miles has long gone her own way. Author Ben Lerner noted in his wonderful interview with Eileen in the Paris Review that, quote, Miles is often referred to as an institution, the way one speaks of a terrific restaurant that's endured the waves of gentrification as a New York institution. But the word bounces off of her. There is nothing official about her, nothing staid or still. She is exemplary for more and more young writers precisely because she has gone her own way. Eileen Miles grew up in Massachusetts and moved to New York City in 1974 in her mid-20s to be a poet, giving her first reading at CBGB's and living the downtown life when, as she writes, days spent sharing an egg with a cat were good days. Since that first reading, she's published 19 volumes of poetry, prose, and fiction, including the iconic Chelsea Girls, originally published in 1994 and recently republished by Echo Press. We have it, I think we have it here tonight. The Importance of Being Iceland, Inferno, a poet's novel, and most recently, I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems, of which one literary admirer noted, 5,000 years from now, people will still be reading Eileen Miles, which I take as a supremely hopeful statement about the state of our planet. Please. Maggie Nelson is the author of 5 books of nonfiction, among them The Art of Cruelty, The Red Parts, Autobiography of a Trial, and The Argonauts, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism. If there are genres to be busted, Maggie's out there busting them. Autobiography, art criticism, poetry, and theory. Eileen Miles has described Maggie Nelson as, quote, one of the wanderers, working the line between worlds while enjoying the road and packing light. Maggie teaches at the School of Critical Studies at CalArts, and we treasure her. Tonight, we'll have 2 readings by our guests, and then they will be in conversation, and then they will invite you to join them. We ask that you ask a question, which is a question if you can. We probably won't get to all of you, but we'll try. And afterwards, there is a book signing and a reception out in the lobby. Please enjoy, and please join me in welcoming 2 great writers, Eileen Miles and Maggie Nelson.
Hi, everybody. How are you? Hi, Eileen. Eileen and I have brought this show to Seattle and New York and I don't know where. Brooklyn, yeah, now we bring it to L.A. But anyway, it's great to see you all. And I'm thrilled to be here with Eileen and at the library and everything. So thanks for coming out. And yeah, so we're both going to read a little bit and then we'll talk and then we can talk with you all. And I have been reading a lot from my most recent book, The Argonauts, and just was kind of flipping through it and feeling like I'd read out everything there was to read in there. So I thought I would read something different tonight. And so when Prince died, I read so many things about so many remembrances, and I just thought I don't have anything to add. But this evening is called Why We Write, and I was thinking about the way that like one thing about I don't have any. There's no answer to the question why you write because I just feel like. I feel like you do it when you can't push things down. So I was on a plane recently, and I just started writing this thing about Prince because I could not write it, right? So I thought I'd read it to you, and then Eileen will read. So in 1984, when I was 10, my father died. He was a small man, 5'5 tops, and jammed with energy. I understood. Energy felt to me then, as it does to so many kids, like an unstoppable force run through a kaleidoscope of affect. Electric, then liquid, then popping, then burning. Above all, it felt uncontainable. The miracle is that our skin contains it for the most part. Was I sexual at 10? I don't know. I know my father died, and then suddenly there was Prince. 1984 was also the year Purple Rain came out. We saw it in the theaters, and then my sister and I watched it innumerable times on the TV downstairs, our lair. I had already watched and would watch a lot of rock musicals. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, The Song Remains the Same, Tommy, The Wall. I liked parts of these movies and had moments of cathexis, but nothing really stuck. Maybe because they were all white British men whose angst was fundamentally inscrutable to May and seemingly tethered to Margaret Thatcher, whoever the hell that was, or grossly thefted from American blues. Maybe it was because the girls in the movies were sticks. Who wanted to be Strawberry Fields all chained up while Aerosmith sings Come Together at You menacingly? That's like the three people who know that movie. Anyway, and while God knows I wanted to be the hippie chick in Led Zeppelin's Going to California, I knew that was just some guy's dream, because the hippie girls I knew that fit the part either had to go along with their hippie fascist boyfriends in a haze of suppressed agency, or they spoke up and the dudes lost interest pronto, as they say. Anyway, that girl was pretty, and she probably liked to get fucked in a field of flowers, blonde ringlets on a velvet blanket strewn with empty goblets. But she was not seething with electric energy, and she didn't talk, and she did not grind. Then there was Purple Rain. Did I want to be Prince, or did I want to be with Prince? I think the beauty is neither. He made it okay to feel what he was feeling, what I was already feeling. I wanted to be a diminutive, profuse, electric ribbon of horniness and divine grace. I bought a white shirt with ruffles down the front, and I wore it with skin-tight, crushed velvet hot pants. I laid a full-length mirror down on the floor, and I slithered on top of the mirror, imitating Prince's closing slither on the elevated amp in Darling Nikki. Yeah, he's telling Apollonia to come back, but you can tell he doesn't really give a shit about Apollonia. He's possessed by something else, his life force on stage. Half-naked, wearing only black bolero pants and a black kerchief tied over the top part of his face, his torso slick with sweat, Prince is telling us a story. It's an important story. The story is of a woman whom he meets while she's masturbating. I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. Not a slut, mind you. She was a sex fiend. Yes, that's it. There's no word in high school for that, because to be a fiend is to be beyond shame. You can make fun of someone whom you think has been humiliated by sucking dick on the playground, but what can you do with a sex fiend? A sex fiend knows how to pleasure herself. A sex fiend knows how to and wants to grind. I wanted to grind. I didn't want to be dominated or to dominate. Maybe that would come later. In 1984, 1985, 1986, all I wanted was to grind. And so I slithered on my mirror and I told my sister to call me Princess. She understood. She was into Wendy and Lisa, the first dykes either of us had ever seen. And the brilliant part was no one had to tell you they were dykes. You just knew, because they were always together, because they played their instruments without self-consciousness, and because Lisa says Wendy, and Wendy answers, yes, Lisa. And so my sister became a dyke, and I became a sex fiend, or I became a dyke, and she became a sex fiend, or we both became neither, or both, or as Purple Rain had it, we became something you'll never comprehend, and that you may be you yourself. I cannot overemphasize the importance of Wendy and Lisa. That they were just there, the first women I'd ever seen as fundamental parts of a band that shredded. They were the stoic guys keeping it together to Prince's histrionic grace. But that's not really right. I never saw Prince as womanly or manly or even as androgynous. He was just beauty, grace, energy, sex, and light. He came undone, he left it all on the floor, and he also moved in tight formation, choreographed chic. The opening chords of Purple Rain, they're just the opening of a conversation, a plaintive, questing conversation. And I might add that they're played, at least in the movie, by Lisa. He was a hot little guy, the kind of guy whose profound sex appeal none of the other guys, certainly not Morris Day, can understand. Morris Day and his macho buddy roll their eyes and shake their heads as Prince starts in on Darling Nikki in the movie. Prince is doing that weird thing with one of his hands that we all imitated, where you make one hand look like it's the hand of another creeping down the side of your face. I know you guys know how to do it. This is Nikki's hand. It's one's own self-pleasuring hand. It's creepy. It's one's own body made another. It's a self-seduction, a magic trick. It's the masturbatory dream that one's hand could feel on one's body the way the hand of another might feel on you. I think this was another of Prince's gifts, to keep self-seduction and allo-seduction on a rollicking continuum, like those rectangular boxes that hold a wave? Why decide between onanism and obsession when you can celebrate the root energy of both? No accident, then, that by 1986, when I wanted to be touched and to touch someone beside myself, I picked out an incredibly small guy who wore eyeliner and lipstick and most definitively was an unrepentant sex fiend. Not in the way that many teenage boys are with their gross language about boning, you know, the Brock Turners or medium-grade wannabe Brock Turners of the world. A sex fiend is someone who actually likes sex. Not the getting off part, but the dirty parts, the salty mess of it. So my androgyn boyfriend liked the mess, and so did I. Grinding that is good enough, you don't need to tell anyone else about it. He certainly didn't tell anyone about it because the other eighth grade boys scorned him for being small and femme and freakish, but he was the only one at that school getting it. I am telling you this now because I hate the way this possibility of experience for boys and girls and everyone in between gets drowned out in moralistic crap about power and consent, all of which is necessary, but it eclipses the real divine electric dirtiness that's possible between excited young bodies who have accepted their desire and somehow found each other. And I want people, especially girls, to know that that is possible, and that it's possible even when you're 13, 15, and it can be great. I recited Darling Nikki like a prayer for 2 years, and then there was high school. Purple Rain's moment had passed, but I'm here going to credit any good that happened on these accounts over the next several years to Prince. He was so many other things besides a sex symbol for suburban white girls like me, so forgive me my momentary narrowness. I'm just struggling to give my thanks. I've wanted to give it for some time. His feminism and queerness and blackness all blazed together, implicit, a streak of insistence on what's possible, a rejection of the paltry ways of being that pretend to be all that's on offer. Tipper Gore had it so wrong. Of all the music, all the forms of sexuality that might have been on offer to the youth in 1984, Darling Nikki was first rate. Female autonomy, mind-blowing, consensual, victimless perversion, and a dirty little prince who wants to grind, 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 grind. Did Tipper ever listen to that strange hymn at the end of Darling Nikki? You have to play it backward, the hallmark and other realms of the satanic. My sister and I played it. We knew what it said. Do you know? It says the Lord is coming. It says Prince is coming. And somehow with his help, she and I learned how to come too.
This is not the thing to talk into. This is so weird. That was so great. I love that. That's amazing. My Prince story is that I got sober to When the Doves Fly. That was totally the theme for me not being fucked up. It was kind of amazing. Just, I feel like this is suddenly like my apartment. I'm just throwing, it was like me and Maggie are roommates and we're living in front of you guys. So I'm going to read poems, and my next book, which probably won't come out for about a million years, because my next book is a book about my late pit bull, Rosie, who died in 2006. But the year after that, I'll have a book of poetry, and it'll be called Evolution. So actually, the first poem I'm reading is not from that, but anyhow, that's the story I'm telling. So this is called Effigy. At home, when a small brown head appeared on the handle of a whacker that I lean on the bookcase, I simply leaned closer. It's just some kind of old metal clamp, not a face, yet the space I'm leaning in is floundering around, tugging closer to that skull, empty eyes, that lolling, stuck-out tongue. This is called You, and I'm actually talking to my computer. After all these years, you should know my font. You should know the numbers go in the middle, what I say. There's so many of you, why don't you talk each time I have to click and press? What's the use of being famous? This one's called Jiggly. It's a lot of these little guys. It was a very spiritual period of time, period of evolution. I keep trying to get it right all night. If you're going the wrong way, you're responsible for everybody, every living thing. Okay. And this is called failed appointment. And my mother is 95 and she's been dying for the past 3 years. And we keep, I mean, I almost say it like a joke, and it almost is a joke in the way that death is kind of a joke. And she's dying to die and she can't die, you know? And so we keep having those like crises where we all come together because this is it. And then she gets better. And then we're all like, okay, you know? And we have all those kind of family fights and intense moments. And so one time my mother was sick in her hospital, and I had a new notebook, and I thought, I'll just sit with her, and she's in this sort of state, and I thought, I'll sit with my dying mother, and I'll write, and it was ridiculous. So this is called failed appointment. If I thought I couldn't write in you ever, throw her out, I did. Time for something new. Your short, broken self requires a brand new weapon, skinny old lady ankles. Nobody sees them. You are my private furniture. We're shocked at her ass. And a bill is stuck to the wall with a knife. At least once we joked about piggies. We were her kids and pretended to care about other people's hearts. And this is sort of an upswing. I feel like the whole thing of a book of poetry is you just go like this for about 3 or 4 years, and then you just pick the peaks and the what do you call the low points? Well, it's like the pits. This is May 26th. I keep to tiny gestures, sweet William, dazzling orange sky, my dying New York. You. I'm bravely eating my croissant at everyone. I'm living on my wet board. I'm living on my money, limits set and the lights lower. I worship the blue marks on the hydrant, how like the name of a flower. And I was touring for the past 70 years I've been touring. And so the thing, I was touring my selected poems, which is reading poems from all these different points in your life and career and stuff. So there was this kind of a lot of being with the past. And then at a certain point, I thought, why don't I just write some new old poems? So this is called Notebook 1981. I was so willing to pull a page out of my notebook a day, several bright days, and live them as if I was only alive, thirsty, timeless, young enough to do this one more time, to dare to have nothing so much to lose, and to feel that potential dying of the self in the light as the only thing I thought that was spiritual possible. And because I had no other way to call that mind, I called it poetry, but it was flesh and time and bread and friends frightened and free enough to want to have another day that way. Tear another page. And this one's called Television. I guess I'm very attached to the small boats moving across the deep blue sea in a world much older than ours, but maybe the same. It speaks to me, the smallness of the boat, the bigness of the night. The shot is wide, and I somehow feel close. I want to speak this enormity to you. I feel like that, or I sing like that, not modern or loose at all. I'm loose like a tiny boat in a wide cove, opening out into a bigger body of water. I relish the small ripples like lines that hold my boat. It's so quiet in the morning. I imagine myself seen, and what's seeing me is a forlorn love. Can you understand this at all? It's kind of lost in a color or a tone, something really old and bound up with everything in the moving picture. And then I am gone. It changes into day or a cartoon, but for the stretch of that voyage, I am known. I was watching Game of Thrones. You know, those huge shots. You're like, oh, my God. It was... Kitchen Holidays. The kettle whistling, and I'm peeling an orange. I'm going to finish in the air of this wild horn. And I splash the boiling water into the French press, splattering water, splashing grains. I'm such an oaf. I wanted to be here with you. Wow, that was a mega oof. I kind of know his leg, right? So this you need to know one thing about this poem I'm going to read. And what it is that a person has bought a window for their house, right? And they bought the window in a town that's like a half-hour drive from where they live. So they put the window in the back of their truck, and they realize that it'll probably bounce out and break on the way to the next town. So they go into the store, and they ask the woman that sold the window to them, can you help me with this? And I have some straps, but I don't have enough. And the woman said, oh, you can borrow my strap. So they strap the window, and then the person drives home to their house, and then they get a phone call from the woman. And somehow, I don't know how it worked, but the woman was like, I forgot to get my strap back from you. Or somehow they need to make a plan. So the first person, who I guess by now is me, says to the woman, you can just come and pick it up. And the woman says, really, I'll come after work with my husband. I said, great. And so, and then the person falls asleep, and then they write this poem. Okay. So you'll know why I told you when we get there. It's called Lark. Anything could possibly, it's so weird. I'm so trained to be talking into this thing. So I'm kind of like falsely blowing something. Anything could possibly become anything else. It was the condition of this dream. Things could blow themselves right into other things, not like a collision, but a blend. It was like there was a wind in this universe and conversion was the rule. I was telling her about the thing ending, and I did notice that who I was talking to was my ex. Not the 2015 one, but the 2013 one. She didn't seem to know who she was or be particularly perturbed not to be herself anymore. She was simply her, thoughtful, even a little concerned. I guess it got weird when I tried to talk about my feelings. Feelings? She shrieked. She became the most magnificent storm, not even a being anymore, but a spell, a giant boat rocking roar. I guess it was pretty absurd of me when you put it like that. Eileen called the voice out the window. She had come with her husband to pick up the strap. Who would want to spend the rest of their life with a fat, bearded man? But of course, that could be Brenda herself. I could be this house or that silvery ceiling lamp looking down my love, that distant car turning, passing, tiny limbs in the blue sky, planes overhead, my fingers on this pen being everyone sighing, turned. So this feels like it went really fast. I have one last poem. Maybe I might jam in one little. This feels right, don't you think? You never have anybody up this close who's like such a good friend as Maggie is. Should I read one more poem, Maggie? But you know what? No, I don't think so. But thank you for that vote of support. I'm just gonna read this last poem, and it's called Sweetheart, but it's two words. It's Sweetheart. I don't think I want you here now. Fresca's got a new look, but I'm not drinking that. My Coke struck the ice and the ice cube cracked. I'm sitting by the little Buddha who is sitting in my yard. I imagine you walking in, gasping at the same couch, the same bed. It's almost the same town, but this is what I meant, and there's so much pleasure, difference in this, that. I meant to be here. One sleeps on what they mean and arises on the decided side, and that's the hope. An entire room is opened by particular feelings that say you're on the edge of the space, and then you wait to watch it grow. Grow like a love or a feeling of distrust or a body grateful for sun and breeze and the rising and falling of my dog's chest. No, gut. The little Buddha's smiling southeast, I figured that out. Their genitals are unknown. In fact, they're everything smiling, walked on by ants, planted in the dirt but not dead, activated by my gaze. Their smiling makes me glad. Dog turns Buddha's way. I go forward with confidence. I may turn nothing up but this gentle scratching in my yard before making a call, opening the self somehow so it's possible to have a friend to call, not only from need but interest in their life, the body I'm pouring into, joyous to be connected to someone well covered by ants, surrounded by breeze, actually touched by birds. Their sound, then landing. There is nothing romantic in their absence. The bird is all touch, no matter how distant their flight. The sky is open. My gaze is wide. It matters how they dive and hover. The silly cluck, the ninny, constant, the hoot makes the gray sky blue. Trees brown, green slanting trees. The woman dying in her face thought, am I recording? But it was the young man counting everything. Cora Crete, whose art I like so much, performed bird in the dying woman's sky. So his quote was reverential, that she could be copying anything, by dying was more about him. A mustache on the sound that life's made of. I think you don't miss me enough, or you regard me as seasons that simply come. And it's true, I'm everything. I used to love so much to show you my poems, but everything's not enough. You have to go out and shake everything's hand, and the tremendous feeling of everything is not shook enough. I'm sick of being God for you. I'm not the fresca or the Buddha or the bird. I'm the ice that cracks. I'm really feeling it now. The amazing difference of contact, everything's gasp. It begins so slow. Hours of freezing, waiting, a life and the draining of it by waiting too long. Riding around in my car, I'm not any Coke, I'm every Coke. And a bird likes the sound of that. To be so close, the earth parts for its own arrival. The time of day is enchanted by my jeans on the line. I'm enchanted by everything, too. How could I be it and feel it? Drawing sunlines, sticks. If I say two again, and I'm creating a pattern, someone who doesn't love me will say, you say two too much. I suppose going blind is momentarily seeing colors in everything and remembering them for the rest of your life. I'm afraid to tell you I'm going blind. What I'm saying is I'm retiring from God. I will feel my genius quietly, the furrows of a dead tree accepting my love. You start like a car and pepper in a number of growls. That's dog. You roll in your bird, and Buddha's difficult now. More of an aside. That something so different as the sun could turn, I think, and we're turning on our dirty little urn. There's a movie about everything, my getting this part of that, endlessly obliged to be wise. Upstairs, 16 little eggs turn in another galaxy, someone else's sandwich. Today, I was so busy, I didn't even see lunch. I had it, but I didn't see it. At all. The distant eggs are turning for someone else. I poured a fresca into my glass, and then I poured my vodka, and then I got drunk. Darker day now when my throat fills, and Buddha's awake. A bee wants to sting me, and in that moment, I would notice everything. Why do you think I'm sweet? Why must I die? Thanks.
All right, this is the unchaperoned part of our,
event. Unchaperoned.
Exactly.
The teenagers are out yakking.
I know. Well, Eileen.
Maggie.
We have a lot to catch up on.
I know. We haven't talked for like months. We've been meaning to. We've been texting.
Yeah, and so now we're going to do the non-texting part of our conversation. But see, I've been following a lot of things that have been happening with you from afar.
Likewise.
Well, just things, but I...
That wasn't a question, but I was likewise.
No, but I think, well, I mean, we were talking before this about things that are cul-de-sacs you don't want to get into, and I think that one of the things that is maybe one of those cul-de-sacs is this, everyone keeps saying, like, how's you? You've had a big year, Eileen, you know, and it's just like a lame cul-de-sac. But there's something I did have as a question.
I know, I was really scared of that one.
I know, but I think I'm interested in, like, for all, you know, for so long you have, like, I think about, like, I don't think about fame as a very interesting topic generally, but for so long in your work you have actually, like, kind of theorized anonymity, knownness, like, the process of people getting to know something that isn't you, like, mm-hmm. either it'd be like the comic book figure of Eileen or all these different figures, or even like, you know, I'm not God anymore, but all these kind of like metonyms, you know, mm-hmm. as they move through the world. And I just wonder if there's anything in the past, you know, while that's happened with, just in the past year or so that's made you, that's changed or altered course or deepened any thoughts that you've had about anonymity and knownness, you know?
Oh, God. That's the hardest question in the world.
Great, okay.
the only thing I think of is the more you seem known, the more whatever anonymity is something that you want, right? You even like, or not even anonymity. What is it when you're alone? You know, right. What is it when you're just sort of with yourself and you're kind of like you have that amazing breakthrough experience where you're not even watching yourself? You know, because sometimes I think writers, and even the right kind of, this ways, I mean, our writing is vastly different in certain ways, but then vastly similar in other ways. And one of the ways it's similar is self-consciousness, mm-hmm. you know, and negotiating that and unloading it in various ways, you know, and by various kinds of excess and holding back and all that. But someplace in there is this desire to sort of vanish into your own existence and just sort of be there and be present, you know, and feel that sweetness, which I have to segue into one of my topics. So now we're going to...
Okay, great.
Which is, I mean, like, I happened to start reading. So we've been, you know, trying to get in touch for months. And so when I looked up Maggie today, I suddenly see this amazing, this Carolee Schneeman essay that you wrote. And then I thought, oh my God, I got this like months ago and I haven't read it, you know, and I started to read it and it was so interesting. But there was something in there that made me, I think you were talking about Carolee Schneeman doing this work with photographs of dead cats, mm-hmm. you know, and it was really kind of bizarre and Baroque and stuff. And then I started to think about us in terms of death and dying and mm-hmm. excessive topics and subject matter and stuff. And then, you know, my next book is about a dead dog and it started with the dog dying and then mm-hmm. it went on. And then I thought about both of us have these lost fathers in yeah. sort of weird ways young. You know, like suddenly you're in this strange space. You're tossed into the space by yourself, which, I mean, you know, life does all the time, right?
Yeah.
But it's very particular, I think. What age were you when your dad died?
10.
Yeah, and 11.
And you were 11, right? Yeah. Yep. And your dad died when he was 44.
Yeah.
Mine was 40, yeah.
Yeah, it's so weird. And so it gives you a different feeling about whatever this journey is that we're all on. Right? Like, how do I, every now and then I'll meet somebody. I mean, there's lots of people in the world who like this, and they'll say, they'll be 30, they'll be 40, they'll be 50, and they'll say, I've not really been touched by death. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, I'm a little weird. And I'm thinking, no, you're not a little weird. A lot of people in the world have, right now, we're in a world of such refugee crisis and so much loss and so much war, and there's so much pain and suffering. But still, there's still a shitload of people who have not seen that much at all. So I think the experience of having this one ding sort yeah. of early on kind of makes you on a certain journey that you can do many things with. You could just shut down and become an extremely neurotic person, which I'm not sure I haven't done too,
right.
but and found writing. But it's just like, I feel like I think of it as the Buddhist thing. When something happens that's completely unexpected, you get this,
yeah.
you know, and they always use that as a teaching tool, you know, like boom, you know, and right. it's like, oh my God, all times come together. You know, what do you do with that? And it's sort of a question in itself.
Well, you were the person, the only person actually, but now I know better that because you were 11 when your dad died, but when I told you that and I've been 10, you said something like, really hard age to lose your father. And I was like, it really was, you know, like as if nobody had ever said that before. But I think, yeah. but it's really ironic that the piece that Eileen sent me this text earlier today so we could talk about our dead dads, and then I realized that the piece about Prince, weirdly, that I wanted to read tonight starts with my father died when I was 10, you know, 1984, and I think that, but when I read this scene, I mean, I also was reading it in an interview with you talking about the way that, I mean, this is no surprise about so-called primal scenes, but that, you know, we tend to return to them over and over again in our work. So I've like revisited your father's death scene with you, via you, yeah. in different places or different guises. And I feel like I've also revisited the scene of, I mean, your dad died when you were in the house and we found my dad dead, but like, you know, these kind of, you know, wormholes that you keep going back to and revisiting. But interestingly, when you were talking, is that you were, I think, connecting that sense of early death with a kind of privacy. And I think what's weird about the age of being 10 and what I was kind of trying to touch base with again with the whole like imitating Prince thing when I was writing that was that it's also an age where you're kind of birthed into self-consciousness. And I remember very clearly writing one of my first written pieces was I wanted to write, you know, something to read at my father's funeral, and I gave it to my mother, and she was like, it's not specific enough. You gotta go back.
Oh, weird.
My mom's an editor. Yeah, this is more personal than I've ever gotten in my writing.
This is great.
So, I know, so she was like, you know, go back and put some more specific memories in or something. You know? Like,
oh my God.
These are platitudes, right?
Yeah.
So sorry, Mom, if you watch the live stream. But anyway, so I was like,
that's
but I was thinking that it was really this awesome moment of self-consciousness about like presenting, like wanting to present and just show and expose and feel grief or be a part of this ceremony, but also be like, oh, I'm presenting here and it has to be good enough and it
right.
has to be specific apparently.
Yeah.
But you know, but a really weird, And then the way that grief is kind of a performance and not a performance both, you know, and writing touches that, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'm reading, you know, in my travels, I've also thought about, what's your day like? And I thought, what's my day like? I mean, if you're traveling a lot, yeah, the thing, it's a nice thing about having one of those years is that you're traveling all the time and you start to think about how it is you really want to live.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like right now my favorite part of traveling is waking up, like being on a plane and being asleep, and then waking up at an airport, and then going out and getting a really strong cup of coffee, and then getting like sushi, and having this like, you know, these two worlds hit, like protein and coffee, and suddenly it's like you're just clapped awake in this crazy airport. And for some reason, it's the greatest high. I just feel like it's all going to be okay because there's caffeine, because there's raw fish, because I can buy it, because there's this, you know, all these people are walking by going places, and it's so amazing.
But you also seem, I mean, since Eileen and I haven't talked for a while, I'm going on all the things I've garnered from afar, so you can tell me that if they're not true. But it seems like, you know, it seems like you, just like you're describing, like I've often, like, are able to find, like, you know, like that you are able, like maybe in that traveling, and you say, thinking about how you want to live, like I feel like you're able to find how you want to live in every moment with the coffee and the sushi or on the road or these different things. And I also think of that as relationship to poetry where like, I'm not doing like a mea culpa thing anymore. Like about when people say, are you ever going to write poems again? And I go, I don't know. Yes, I hope I do someday. But like, I've kind of let that all go and be like, maybe not. I don't know, you know, but I also feel like that there's something about the belief in the poem is a belief that the moment is good enough to scribe it, you know, and that you never have lost that. And I think I've lost it a little bit.
See, I just think you've lost it into prose.
Well, it's true.
I mean, like, what's the difference?
I know, it's true. It is true. Yeah.
Because the way stuff, like, from the Carolee Schneeman, my favorite line, it was so amazing. You were talking, it's a quote from her, but you picked it. I'm just some part of nature that keeps pouring and pouring and pouring. I was like, holy, that's so much, the female writer, the female artist, the person I want to hear about, that it's sort of like, that is giving us something that perhaps we've not been expected to want or need or know or understand, and yet she's unable to do anything other than to keep giving and making and you know, creating, which is absolutely the way I see you as a person responding to life and its conditions and the situations you find yourself in. I mean, that's like, yeah. I mean, we can call it a lot of things. I mean, I did think that too, like us talking here today, what would we call this that we're doing? But you can call it a lot of things, but one of them is poetry, you know?
It's funny because, Carolee Schneeman, you guys probably know, is this, she actually wants to be identified more as a painter, but, you know, most people know her as a performance artist. And but it's funny because I wrote this long piece about her that'll come out this year, and then I gave it to Eileen. But when I was looking through it, I actually pulled out the exact same quote. What was interesting was that the context that she was talking about was when someone was asking her. So Carolee, like a lot of female artists, has a kind of ongoing, ongoing reality and acute feeling. Not necessarily in her case a bitter one, just a kind of a noticing of things that she's done being picked up and, you know, used by, moved around in the culture, but not necessarily credited to her. So she has this amazing book that she keeps, a big scrapbook of places she sees her art being used in the culture. So and she showed me the scrapbook when I was interviewing her, and then that scrapbook is actually going to be the visual text that will accompany this essay I wrote. And it's all just pictures of other people. Like Carolee did this piece where she was strapped into a harness and like drawing on the walls, called Up to and Including Her Limits. And then, you know, in... what movie is it? I don't know. Julianne Moore is this artist who is strapped into a harness, drawing on the walls, whatever. So she has pictures of Julianne Moore from the movie, you know, stuff like that. Another artist is interviewing her and talking to her about Matthew Barney and saying that their drawing restraint pieces are really similar, but Barney's, you know, gotten a lot more, you know, whatever, money, recognition. And she says, and they say, what do you have to say about that? And she says, well, I can't speak to that except to say, I have my usual wonder as to why I'm so unattractive to promotion machines. I guess I'm just some part of nature that keeps pouring and pouring and pouring. So it's just interesting to put that in the context of you, of us both pulling that out as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
I remember hearing some guy say about some female artist, "Oh, she's just an endless woman." We were like, right. It was so incredible. I was like, "Wow, he just said it."
An endless woman.
It was just like,
yeah,
the unimaginable.
That's super funny. That's super funny. I mean, because there are these two different kinds of approaches, I think, that we both also do, too, which is there's a poetry where you're kind of scribing, as you've said, like what's coming down the river, you know. And then there's the kind of things I think we've both done in the prose, like in Inferno and in Cool For You, and then, you know, in books of mine like The Red Parts or other things where you, you draw a kind of temporal or thematic circle around a period of life and kind of choose it really tightly as like this is, you know, 14 to 19 or this is The Color Blue or whatever, and then you kind of experiment with refracting life not as it's kind of not as the flow but through a lens, you know, and it's a kind of it's not like stop footage, but it's like, to me, it's like a huge eddy, you know, as opposed to trying to you know, get at the now, although obviously the now is what you're doing when you're writing, because you're looking down from the now, like Virginia Woolf said, you know, through the down through the pond, you know.
But truly, yeah, like by picking something, by staking out a territory or saying there is such a thing as subject matter here, what you get to witness is this movement of the mind over it.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh God, what was I watching on the plane? Revenant? How do you, that incredible to be hated movie? But it was like, there was an amazing moment where he built this like little eddy of rock, I guess, is that what an eddy is? It was just like a little pile of rocks, and then invariably fish would get caught in there, and then he put his man paw in and ate the raw fish, you know. But it's sort of like it's a way to capture, and it's just a way to and it's I don't know, it's almost like it's almost a way to claim you're doing work,
right? Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
which
right.
is like poetry. You're just like, you are doing work, but it sort of doesn't look at, especially because somebody will, like, the worst thing for a poet is if somebody will say, what's your poetry about?
Right.
You know? And it's just like, there's just absolutely no answer to that, you know? And you can throw some stuff out, like landscape and love and death and little news, you know, vernacular, you know? But it just all feels silly, you know? Because it's not about anything except going about, you know? And I think when you do, I mean, because I do what you do sometimes, but you do what you do all the time.
But I think, you know, what's interesting, and I was reading an interview with you today or yesterday that where you were talking about something about how people in the 80s, you were saying, used to be really into the word rigor. And I was laughing because I remember very clearly that when I graduated from college, my thesis advisor took me out for lunch and we toasted and she said, to rigor, you know. And for years I thought that was kind of like the best toast, like what you were supposed to toast to, you know. And but it also felt like, I mean, kind of like you're saying, like the excuse for writing, like to me, I was like, I'm rigorous. I do rigor, you know. But what I loved what you were saying in this interview though, where you were saying, so I guess the subject matter in a way is like announcing rigor, like as if you're really researching The Color Blue when you're just actually kind of, you know, snip-snapping around. But like, but you said something in that interview, you said, you know, you were like, fuck that, like blah. Every time someone said rigor, you felt like blah. You felt like it was more interesting. I don't know what you said, but something about like this fog of incoherence and the amazement of things being able to bubble out of that incoherent state. And that seemed really interesting to me.
Right, because it looks like it's not going to work. And that's always exciting to me.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I mean, every time I have to write something, I feel that way. Like, oh, this will be the time. Let's prove that I'm completely and utterly mad. And I have no ideas. And I can't write. And it's all over. And you just sit there, you know. And then you somehow trick yourself backwards into actually sitting down and beginning to write, and then something happens, and it's so weird, you know.
It's so enviable because, like, the dog book. When's the dog book coming?
April of 17.
Okay, and what's it called?
Afterglow, a memoir.
Right. But Eileen had been telling me for years she was writing a book about her dog Rosie, and then gave it to me a manuscript to read. And what's so obviously, like, I mean, again, you say in conversation, I'm writing this about my dog, but then like it was probably, you know, I mean, it's a close race, but when I read it, my overwhelming feeling was like, this is the wildest thing Eileen's yet written, you know? Like, it felt really, but it felt like your description of it, I mean, it just felt like maybe just by saying, well, you told me that it was Rosie, you know, dog, and obviously spelled backwards is God, so it's kind of like the book feels like it, you know, there's one dog in question, but it goes for God in this way that nothing I'd read of yours really did. It was pretty amazing.
Because how can you go for God?
Exactly.
You know?
But you did it.
I mean, you guys can go for God, yeah. But maybe I can't do it right now. No. You're having that ecstatic look.
I know.
You're going for happening.
I'm just thinking about wildness, and I'm thinking about there's a part in the Argonauts where I'm talking about my beloved Harry's writing and saying that I'm jealous of it because whenever I read it, it feels so much wilder than my writing. And then somebody, Dana Ward, who we both know, was very kindly said to me once something like, I was lamenting that, and he said something like, you know, I'm like rehearsing a compliment here for you all, so I'm sorry about this setup, but he was saying something. He said there can be something wild in radical sanity, you know, which is what this book feels like, you know?
Uh-huh.
But I thought that was really kind of him, you know, but I felt like, is it true? I don't know if it's true or not, but I feel like there's something, I feel like you've written a lot about this too in terms of like, I was reading the Paris Review interview where you were talking with Ben Lerner about what you got from getting sober in your writing. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's a kind of wildness that a kind of radical sanity allows that isn't necessarily available otherwise that mm-hmm. you got too, you know.
Well, I love this the sound of this idea of radical sanity. And I think that definitely when I first stopped drinking and taking drugs, I wanted something like that, and I feel like I pretended to be doing something like that.
Yeah.
But then I realized, or wanting to seem as wild as you were when you were wild, you know? And it seemed like once you gave up the pretense and stopped trying to convince people you were wild, you just started discovering this real wildness,
right?
You know, which is the way things actually are, that it's like existence is uncanny, you know, and that every day is kind of remarkable, you know, but it's sort of like we're usually so stressed. I mean, like when I... You know, I guess it was in Marfa, like I was in, you know, like a 7-Eleven or something. And this is very classist, but I was just like, the woman at the register was saying, oh my God, I'm so busy, I can't even go to my kid's recital. You know, and I was like, she can't even go to her kid's recital. And she worked, you know, it was just kind of like, everybody's too busy. We're all crazily too busy. And it seems like the really radical step is to figure out how to not be too busy and to absolutely figure out how to see what's there, which is just people's most passionate desires being enacted slowly or quickly, you know? I mean, like by you making the aquarium be your family and your life, you know, it's just like, you know, and you said like, of course, you know, some film crew wants to come and like, you write the beautiful book that deconstructs what it's like to be in a family that's really ordinary and really quite radical, you know? And then people read it and love it and think this is an amazing book because it is an amazing book. And the next step is, let's go into your house with a camera and take a, you know, and make a movie about this radical family. And that's insanity. That's right. Not radical.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. No, I was telling Eileen about some offers that had come in since the book had come out.
But part of it is that the beautiful act is not enough. And the hard thing is to say, like, that's a real Eddie, to say the beautiful act is enough.
Right. Right. You know? You mean of writing?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people always say that, you know, writers want to talk about form and everybody else wants to talk about content, you know, but it does seem true mm-hmm. that, like, the content to me is often, like, you need enough of it to do the formal experiment.
You know? Right, right, yeah.
But that it's a, I mean, like, The Argonauts is about what it's about, but it, in my mind, you know, it has like a phosphine or a skeleton that it could be about anything mm-hmm. in a way, but I found the, like, the tone or the holder or the form of the thing, which was the project, you know, mm-hmm. which is something about how to think, how to think on the page through and with, you know, like, I guess would be the skeleton of that for me, mm-hmm. you know, so the content seems like coloring in a coloring book or something that somebody else can fill in, you know.
Except that you have to love what there is a unspoken relationship, right. Which is that you have to love the subject.
Right.
You know, like, that's like, because that makes you want to do the work or the coloring, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of, I mean, content also could be everything. It just might be that it has to be repressed for me to write anything, you know? I'm happiest when I can start thinking about form, and that, because then your unconscious is doing the work of the content without you having to say, I'm writing about X, you know, you're mm-hmm. just kind of going on it, you know. But I wonder if, I don't know, I feel like a small bird told me that there were like four books coming out soon, and that one of them was an Eileen Miles reader, is it true?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Yeah. are you picking the selections yourself?
Yeah, I sort of I'm already kind of absentmindedly doing it, which is kind of fun to think, because it really is like your greatest hits in a way. It's like, what would you, if this small, I mean, like to me, my aesthetic ideal is the small volume that, like, whether it's, like years ago, I had a friend who was like a poet, but sort of, I don't know why this is an important fact, that she was sort of mentally ill, and her boyfriend was a super in a building, and so the basement of this building was her office, and it was crazy, and it was in the summer, and it was hot. We would spend all this time hanging out in her basement just talking. And I remember she showed me this thin volume of poetry, and I'll never know if it was Tu Fu or Li Po, whoever, and I remember picking it up and looking at it and seeing that it was this guy's whole life. There was just like one little child poem and one slightly older poem and mm-hmm. one, and it was just like you could put somebody's whole life in a volume, you know? And I think it's so exciting, you know, like we write and write and write, and it's like you don't know where any of this work is going, and it's found to be reduced, if not entirely lost. You know, so the idea of actually doing the losing and reducing yourself mm-hmm. is really exciting. So I think it's really fun to think of your work as like this candy store, and mm-hmm. you can kind of—it's not just a selected thing, but if I were to give you, I mean, like if somebody, what's your writing mm-hmm. like? You would just hand them the small volume, and it would mm-hmm. just be your happiest projects. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's it's cool. But the other thing, they're real—it's Grove, and they're being really smart. Like I'm doing the dog book, and in it, there's this crazy lecture about foam. And in that, there's like a class that I taught at UCSD called Pathetic Literature. So they're so cool. They were like, we want the Pathetic Anthology next. So it's sort of like there's all these embedded things. So each book opens, and then there's something else inside there that yields the next book. So it's actually really fun. They're being a really
great publisher. The Pathetic thing is an anthology, or is it?
Pathetic Literature is an anthology.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll be, you can.
Oh, great.
I can find something.
I'm sure you can.
You probably touched it for a moment at least.
That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. What do you think? You want to keep talking, or you want people to?
I feel the Q&A is. I feel like Q&A is upon us.
All right.
Crazy.
The microphones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Raise your hands. Question.
I think we did okay.
Not pathetic.
Only slightly.
Only slightly.
No one wants to be the first. Okay, one right over here. Go over here. Hi. On the sort of road to finding your voice, was there any sort of particular burst that you felt like was the most valuable? Or had the most effect, both of you?
You said burst?
Yeah, burst, like things kind of crystallized or became a lot more clearer.
Is that to both of us, or either of us, or? Did you?
Well, not to be too insular, but seeing Eileen Reid in 1992 was a pretty big burst that I had for me. But, you know, it's funny because I was talking to someone back to this, you know, boring fame question, but they said Eileen's always been the most famous person any of us ever knew. And but I think that what the person was saying was that, like, it's not about fame. It's about, I mean, I've said this before, and you've said this, too, about other people, but that, like, you know, when you're growing up, you don't, you're moving around in the dark, and then you see something, and you're like, whatever outlet that is, I'm plugging into it, you know, mm-hmm. And Eileen has said this before about, like, I don't know, about, I can't remember who, maybe Paul Violi, or somebody that, like, you just decide to believe, you know, and then in retrospect, you often realize, you know, you can see all the reasons why your choices were the right choices, but, you know, I mean, Eileen, for me, was really, like, you know, I didn't know what to do with myself when I was 20, but it was like, well, Eileen Miles teaches in New York City, so you could move there and take classes with her. And I was like, okay, that seems like as good a beacon as anything, as good an outlet as, you know, anything else. And so there you have it, you know.
I don't know what to say to that. Yeah.
Seems overdetermined now, but, you know.
I think like the Carol Lee line. I feel like when people talk about voices, I mean, you sound like you, and I sound like me in my writing. But I think the thing that's more the point, and maybe even how I interpret your what you say, it's like you find a tap, you know, inside of yourself, and you just figure out a way to keep pouring, you know. And that's the thing. It's sort of like it's not so much what you sound like, but what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And that isn't anything in particular except this order of things. Like suddenly you start to find the right order, you know, and that's when you feel like you really. I feel like, oh, that's a poem. You know, it's sort of like I was writing these things. And suddenly it's sort of like they started to, the pieces that liked each other started to find each other. And it's like, and the thing, it wasn't so much the thing was endless, but the thing, I could feel this, that non-stopping thing, you know? And so it's like not so much a voice as like a rhythm, I guess,
mm-hmm.
is what I feel like is the thing that drives the work. It sounds like a voice, but inside, I think, you know what it is? It's like the difference between inside and outside.
Mm-hmm.
Like inside, it feels one way, and outside, it sounds like this other thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it's a satisfied sound.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to comment. You're right. When you do see death as young, you really live each day even more. I myself lost mine as young. My question is, other than your father's, what family member has influenced you a lot in your writing?
Mm. Well, my mother, the editor, as I've already outed, is all to you. And clearly, when someone dies in your family, especially a parent, you know, you can do this terrible splitting where the dead one becomes the holder of all energy, grace, sexuality, wildness, and then the other one becomes, you know, your superego, you know, which is what I definitely did with my mother and my father. Mm-hmm. But I think in some ways, whatever that split was, probably characterizes my writing, and I probably need them both. So,
yeah, I feel like it's weird. I've never thought this to this extent, but in some a certain way, I feel like your family makes you work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of why they're so
uncomfortable. Makes your work.
Makes your work come into existence, even.
Yeah.
It was sort of that system of crazy people
that
you live with, that you desperately started running inside of yourself to find a place and find a place. And you probably didn't find it then with them, but you found some place, you know, for yourself in the world that recapitulated somehow what that system put you through in a way, you know. I like my mother, you know, I've never thought of my mother as having anything to do with my writing except that she was she's an amazing storyteller. She's real, I mean, very clipped, you know, and she has a great voice, and she read to us, you know, and she really read, really, she was a great reader, you know. And I had a grandmother, Irish grandmother, who was in a mental hospital, who just kind of mumbled, and I was obsessed with her. But when I started to write, I thought I was going crazy, and I thought I was her. You know, and it was kind of an amazing, scary, horrifying thought. But I was always wanting to know more about who she was and what she had, you know, and what she sounded like, you know. So I think the family is really weirdly such a root of what we do.
Hi, this is from Aggie. Hi.
Where are you? Hi.
I'm over here. So you were talking about form and content in the Argonauts, and the form is really fantastic in the book, and it's strange and wonderful, but the content is so deeply and profoundly important and great, and for many people probably in the audience here and certainly in the wider audience that you're gaining, it is new. And you know, you seem to just now kind of say, oh well, the writing is the form, but the content. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about how you really felt about exposing that content. And I know that you say you never think about repressing anything personal, but about going the distance in that book.
Yeah, well, I think what I said, my latter comment about repressing content is probably more accurate, because I think that... you know, I remember very well the day when I was talking to my agent person about like two different book ideas I had, and I described them both. And of course, the one that I could barely get the words out about the content was the one he was like well, that's clearly the one that you need to work on next. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm not going around being like, you know, doing the like, you know, as it was once put somewhere, like the queer mom-war or whatever, you know. I was like, I'm just not doing that. Like, and I was, you know, matrophobic, just the way that everybody is matrophobic in regards to literature and stuff like that. So it was like, I think in a way, it wasn't that the content itself I was actually phobic about. It's like there's the boogeyman version of your content, which is like the just like I said, you know, like the mom-war, like the kind of just tinny version of what you're doing that runs alongside what you're doing that you don't want what you're doing to be, you know? And I feel like you're trying to keep your thing on this side and kind of keep making this distinction and keep it interesting. And I think it's repressing the bad possibility that you're afraid of that, like, I think is what really, like, you know, I have to do with content, you know? And I think, and I mean, I say in The Argonauts that like all my writing usually seems to me like a bad idea, you know? And I think that, and then it's hard to tell which is the bad idea because it's like a good bad idea and which is just a bad, bad idea, you know? And often you don't know till like you write out a lot of things and later you're like, well, that really was a bad, bad idea. And this one's a good, bad idea. But it's, you know, I mean, it is a little frightening. And I think that I had the luck of, you know, when people talk about like, you know, exposure or something in The Argonauts or something, you know, I really didn't, the two books I worked on about my aunt that were about like sexual violence were really much more, like the tenor of that whole experience was much more nerve-wracking to me just because it involved violence, you know, and it wasn't, so I think that in a way, and actually Eileen was a person, not to keep harping on all the great things Eileen has said and done for me over the years, but you know, when I told Eileen the story about my aunt's death and I wanted to write about it, but again, I felt like I couldn't really do it. Eileen said like, you know, like I said, why would I do it? And Eileen was like, why wouldn't you do it? Like you're a writer and this is a story in your family. So you kind of like it's kind of a no-brainer that you're going to write about this. And it was just that kind of shifting of permission of like, you know, not why would I, but why wouldn't I, that that like with that push, I think, you know, that was more of a crucible for me in terms of making that kind of like a leap. And then the other things haven't seemed quite as difficult since, if that makes sense.
It's about the world too, right? When you know, like we talk about not wanting to talk about content.
Yeah.
It's because you already did,
right?
Right. You already. I mean, like you have, you know, like you
right,
have
exactly. yeah.
an aunt who was slain, or you have a particular
right.
family that might seem unique to some people.
Right.
And all those things you live with in your life in the world all the time, and whether you brought up as a kid in a family where the aunt was slain, or
right.
you live in this queer family where. Here it's comfortable, but there it's not comfortable, and you keep changing. It keeps, and it's like you live with all those things, and that very discomfort makes you write it,
right?
You know, and that creates yeah. content. But really, it's something more abstract than that.
Right.
It's sort of like pushing out your actual version, and you know, like almost in resistance to the
right.
kind of people's ideas about the things that you're going through,
yeah.
and remarks somebody might make if they thought you're, you know. So
then
you finish it, you do this beautiful construction, and then people want to talk about the
right.
content.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And that
yeah.
seems crazy because you did it.
Right, yeah.
I think.
Right, yeah.
So it was always about the world, and now the world wants it again.
Right.
You know? But yeah. that's the way it is, right?
Yeah, that is the way it is.
Goes back to when you were talking about being read to, and I just wondered what were the formative stories of your childhood that were read to, and Maggie, perhaps what are the stories that you find now that you love to read to your children?
Did that bounce from me
you
to
go,
Maggie?
You go.
I have one book that I loved so much when I was a kid called Scupper the Sailor Dog.
The Sailor Dog, yeah.
I just loved, I mean, I own the book. A girlfriend found it for me, and she was like, and I was like, it was like going to paradise seeing those drawings again because I had lived them over and over again, but it was a dog in a boat, you know? And it's sort of like you get these pictures when you're a kid and you just go through your whole life thinking, I'm a dog in a boat, you know? And it's like, you want to go where Scupper went, you know, and you're like, and suddenly one day you're standing there, you see those curled toe shoes like they showed to Scupper in the Medina. And I was like, I'm in Istanbul. And I'm like, there are the shoes. You know, so I feel like it's sort of like the scenarios of your life are given to you, and the childhood books that were read to you. They're just kind of dreams being handed.
Skepper's apartment does look a lot like your apartment in the boat.
It's very weird. I saw my apartment and I thought, this is Skepper's.
I thought that too, you know? When I started reading Skepper, Sailor Dog, yeah. Oh gosh, I don't know. It's a work in progress, you know. It's a work in progress. I feel like, a lot of radical political friends of mine recommended Little House on the Prairie books, and I'm now on volume 4, reading them and reading them to your kids. And it's tough. Not that my friends recommended them because the books were political or radical, but as a means of explaining settler logic, and I'm finding it really difficult to explain that right now. But it's a challenging thing to think about because, they're from a white perspective and reading to a white child with a protagonist who's awoken Laura in a world that she doesn't agree with and didn't make, but that is rotten, is really hard to, such as it is today, you know? So figuring out how to explain all that is a task. You know?
Thanks. I think of you both as being very important contemporary contemporary poets, but I would have a hard time putting you in a specific school of contemporary poetry. I think it's interesting that Maggie, you said that you might not write poetry again. Eileen, you've been writing for so long. You've seen many schools come and go, perhaps. And I think Maggie's book on the New York School does a really great job sort of painting you as a latter-day New York School poet. I'm just interested to hear what you guys think about the contemporary poetry scene today. Like, how would you describe it? Because you seem both of it but not in it, or maybe in it but not of it. No, mm-hmm. Probably the first one.
I think we're both very in it, because even if you don't necessarily consider yourself a poet, whatever, I always hate all those poet, rape, when we say words twice, like somehow that tells us more about it. But I think you're certainly a fellow traveler, you know, like Lydia Davis is a fellow traveler. Like there were just prose writers who never, always, certainly wrote poems, but it's sort of like it's a relationship to literature and culture, I think. But I think poetry is in such an amazing position right now. I think it's so cool because I think that there was such a day of schools, and schools continue to be formed because there are ways of people making these, like, you know, like poets have always traveled in small bunches and read to each other and hear each other, and you kind of create you create a community that way. But I think there's a way in which, you know, the world is so open to language through all, like, I mean, like I love to talk about, I mean, social media is really like, I think, a poet's paradise, you know? So I think that there's all these schools of poetry that have come and gone, and it's still, I mean, they're like shirts, you know? It's sort of like a good old shirt is still a good old shirt. So I think you can, I mean, some people would tend to debunk, like, you can't write a New York School poem anymore because we're after that. But I think you can always reach into history and write any style that still works for you, whether it's from your own closet or anybody else's. Poetically, but I think I've sort of experienced this past 20 years, poets really morphing through schools and picking up influences in lots of different directions, and that seems really exciting to not necessarily need to cloister yourself so much from the rest of the culture and the rest of the arts, because I think, you know, it's such an amazing, and the art world is so into poetry right now in such an interesting way, not interested in poetry because poets will write about painters or in that sort of 60s way, but I think there's a sense that you know, visual artists are following poets more and reading the work and finding that to be a new, exciting space of thinking and formation. And, you know, it's like, I just think it's an enormously hot moment for poetry because language is getting rediscovered through all, whether it's texting or social media, people are just naturally fragmenting language and using it again and recombining it in new ways. And, you know, it's really exciting.
That's good.
Okay. Yeah,
that's good.
Let it be.
This, I guess, is a question for both of you.
inspired by a really like maddening, maybe someone else saw this today, an article from the New York Times Magazine that's titled like, "Everybody's calling themselves queer, but is anyone?" and it just talks about how like queer youth culture and celebrity really coalesce to make it very popular, and talks a little bit about the etymology and the origin of the term. But how do you see the current state of like intersectional identity politics, particularly queerness? It's a light one. Thank you.
Whose question is? I only can want to say quickly, I heard that really young kids, like high school kids, are using the term trans queer, which I thought was really interesting and great. You know, roomy. What do you think?
Oh, God. I mean, I think that, what to say? I mean, I haven't seen the piece. I think that, I mean, I go through this a little bit in the Argonauts, but, you know, there's always been, I mean, I go through it vis-a-vis Eve Sedgwick, but there's always been this kind of question about, I mean, I say Eve wanted it both ways. She wanted the word queer to both designate something about, like, you know, same-sex or trans or whatever relationships, like regarding gender and sexuality, while also wanting the word queer to be a huge umbrella that could involve, you know, like doing, you know, ecological work or, you know, whatever, like, you know, really, like, big, you know, kind of thing. And I say, you know, she wanted it both ways. I don't think that, but she says, but it can't lose a relationship to the first, she said, because then it loses all historical specificity. But it's a very, you know, it's a tough question because I don't think that, like, if it's not intersectional at this point, then it's just, then it's kind of a cul-de-sac, you know what I mean? So I don't, and risks being cut off, but I'm not sure that the word is the most, you know, I mean, it was exciting to go to, like, Occupy and have it be, like, you know, queer, you know, whatever, queer Occupy or something. Like, it was exciting to see, like, the word traveling in these other spaces, but I don't know that, like, that we need to, like, you know, we don't need to, like, I mean, Black Lives Matter is, in some ways, started as queer, you know, it actually is not antithetical, but like I don't think it needs to be a word that the way it traveled in the 90s where it's like the verb of like the thing that needs to be done to every movement in order to make it, you know, radical. I think that's not the moment we're in, you know.
I mean, it's sort of like poetry. Words get a really exciting and a really fresh at some point in time and are sort of like vague at other points, you know. I mean, I was at this poetry conference about a week ago and I just, you know, it was a version of what this article, it was just somebody who's very queer was talking about this particular tall, white, seemingly straight guy who's always wanting this very queer guy to know that he's queer. He's always telling me how queer he is. I was like, what does that mean?
I know.
You know, and it was just kind of this like wanting to be let in some way, wanting to be in on certain conversations and feelings and communities and, you know, but the word doesn't give you that,
right.
You know. It's a whole. Because I think the same person like was very. We were all on a panel, and everybody on the panel was either trans or queer, or I guess that's what we were. And then there was this guy who was maybe queer or maybe not, but he was talking about, you know. And we were all guided to take 7 minutes, and he took like a half hour. Continually thinking about new and interesting things that he led into each time with quickly, and just quickly, I'll just say quickly. And it was like every time he said quickly, he took 5 more minutes. And it was sort of like the question, so it's like the point is not whether he's queer or not, or whether he's political or not, but whether he's self-conscious enough to know what he's taking and making and doing in time, you know? It's just like, so I guess words don't matter finally, right? I think.
And on that note,
right. I could get us out of here.
That's your takeaway,
Right. Maggie and Eileen, I want to thank you for letting us in on your conversation. It was really great. Thank you so much. And join us afterwards in the lobby and in the courtyard.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.